afternoon to the members of the court and opposing counsel. My name is Ron Voss. My Colorado bar number is 15374. I want to talk a little bit about some of the facts of this case, just because they pertain to the counterclaims that we believe were improperly dismissed as discovery sanction. This case involves a development in southern Colorado that consisted of basically what I'm going to call two parcels of property. One parcel of property was owned by an entity called River Island Ranch, and another parcel of property was owned by an entity named Rio Grande Ranch. Had some of the same common members. Well, there's a man by the name of Thomas Smith who had issued a loan to essentially the same borrowers that are involved in this case pertaining to the Rio Grande Ranch property. And so those two pieces of property were codependent. So for instance, water rights, there's struggles over water rights. If somebody had better water rights, those properties might sell better than others. And what happened is the appellants, including my clients, including other members of Rio Grande Ranch, took out a loan with Pueblo Bank and Trust. The amount of the loan was about $3 million. And as part of that loan, the Pueblo Bank and Trust required that each of our clients issue guarantees. And those guarantees then stated a face amount of X number of dollars. And I think you've all seen that in the brief in terms of the discussion of that language. But that's important because that face amount was tied to a specific percentage of ownership in the entity itself. And as you can see from the affidavits that were attached in the record, that it was the understanding that the maximum liability that any of these individual guarantors would have would be that face amount, the 150% of what their of their total interest in the property, or the proportionate interest in the property. Well, what happened is the things were going along okay, and then the major recession hit. Our clients at that point, or my clients along with other members of River Island Ranch, had were concerned about how they were going to sell lots and make payments on these loans, and had discussions with the bank, and things seemed to be going along well. And then as the economy worsened, things became more difficult for my clients. It turns out that at that point in time, the bank was engaging in discussions with Thomas Smith, who at that point was also not only a lender of my clients and others, but also a competitor for the development, for the overall development. So if he could acquire both pieces of property, he would make a lot more money than what he otherwise could. And so what he did is the bank talked to him, and unbeknownst to my clients at the time, the bank had turned over all of their personal financial information that they had gained under the terms of the guarantees to Thomas Smith. When they had favorable discussions with Thomas Smith going in, all of a sudden the tone changed. He wouldn't talk to them anymore. And you'll see from the affidavits on file that one of the things that came out and one of the things that had been pursued in these counterclaims in this case is that Thomas Smith then at that point took a look at the financial information and had determined our clients couldn't come out of this. The downturn they were having with Pueblo Bank Trust, weren't going to be able to pay off the loan, and he saw an opportunity to take the land for pennies on the dollar. And so at that point in time, there's nothing in the guarantees that allows for the disclosure of that information, and Colorado case law suggests that it's private and confidential, and there are penalties associated where it's a civil wrong for having done something like that, and there's damages associated with it. Those facts give rise to the counterclaims that are ultimately dismissed in this case.
Counsel, but you never really reached the merits, or the trial court didn't that, right? This is primarily up here on procedural issues.
It is, Your Honor. But I wanted you to understand, I wanted the court to understand that there is merit to the counterclaims that were ultimately dismissed. And I just wanted to give that brief background on, and I'll proceed in the rest of the argument.
Yeah, the hurdle for you, it seems to me, today to get over is the procedural arguments in which the case was dismissed on. So okay. If you could address those, I'd appreciate it.
All right, Your Honor. Let's take that dismissal then, since I start talking about the counterclaims, because there's really two components to this case as far as I'm concerned. One are the improper granting the motion for summary judgment, which was deemed confessed contrary to Colorado case law, and then also the dismissal of the counterclaims. Now, in this case, you have to, if you can recall from the brief, there's some procedural background that's also important here. For instance, my clients, when they first came into this case, were represented by another Colorado Springs law firm. That law firm was a counsel for them at the time disclosures were due, at the time discovery requests were submitted to them, and at the time a motion for summary judgment was filed, which is the other part of the argument. And that counsel then basically did nothing with the motion for summary judgment, filed a motion to withdraw in the case in sometime in July of 2011, I believe. I'm losing track of my years here, but I think it was 2011. And when they filed that motion to withdraw, they didn't procedurally maybe do things correctly. But the important point is, at that point in time, the motion for summary judgment is still outstanding. They had turned over my client's disclosure documents in August of 2011. They filed a motion to withdraw in July and were allowed to withdraw in August. They filed the disclosure documents in August. So the bank had those in its possession. Then at that point in time, my clients were unrepresented by counsel. They thought that the bank was interested in trying to settle the case. I know that's not justification for lawyers not to do things, but sometimes clients get caught off guard by that. Then in an important point, an important date, I think, is September 1 of 2011. And that was the time when there was supposed to have been a status conference that was set. The bank had scheduled for a setting for a status conference. And my clients called in for the setting and got on the phone, and they were just dropped. They were hung up on. And you can see from the record, my client thought that he had been rebuffed by what he called the Milstein law firm at that point. And I'm not critical of the law firm. This is just an oral argument. That's what the client said. And that's important because at that point in time, remember, we had a motion for summary judgment that was outstanding. At that point, also, the bank had filed a motion to compel with respect to discovery responses that had not been submitted. If that status conference would have occurred, I don't think we would be here arguing today, at least over the dismissal of the counterclaims on a discovery motion.
Mr. Voss, if I understand correctly, that status conference was after the prior law firm had already been allowed to withdraw. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So Mr. and Mrs. Lanoska knew that they were proceeding pro se, and with the Milstein firm's motion to withdraw, they had been advised of their responsibilities, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the point is, my point is, Judge, Your Honor, that they were trying to live up to those responsibilities, because they called in for the setting on the status conference. The status conference was never set. And then procedurally, what happens after that, and my clients told the Fremont County Court judge that at that point in time, they were looking for some guidance in terms of procedure, what had to happen, and they weren't given that opportunity. Then on September 7th, the law firm for the bank filed a status report where they make reference to the motion to compel. They did not seek under Rule 121.115 for an immediate finding or a determination of that motion. And I think that's kind of significant. They reference the motion to compel, but don't draw it to the court's attention. And at that point in time, too, the motion for summary judgment had been pending. The court then ruled on the motion for summary judgment on September 14th of 2011. At that point in time, the court's clerk thought that the case had all been dismissed with a finding on the summary judgment. The case was taken off the court's docket on that day. So now we're back at September 7th. We've got this slight mention of the motion to compel, and then we have the case going off the court's docket on September 14th. After September 14th, the bank had correspondence with my clients talking about setting their depositions, make no mention of the failure to file responses to these interrogatories and outstanding discovery requests. Now we fast forward to November 9th of 2011. That's a couple months after the original motion, after the SAS conference should have been set. At that point, they filed a motion for sanctions, the bank did, for failure to provide responses to discovery requests. That's the first mention that they had made of it at that point in time. And remember, the clock's ticking now as we're getting closer to trial. We got a January 30th trial date. Something that could have been addressed in September isn't a problem. Something that now gets pushed back 2 months, not because of my clients, well, in part at least because of what the banks decided to do about how to approach the case, in part because the case had taken off the docket. Now it becomes a problem. So on November 9th, that was that motion was filed. On December 6th, 2011, there was a status conference. My clients appeared at the status conference. The judge had ruled on the motion for sanctions at that point in time and issued an award of attorney's fees for failure to appear at depositions and gave my clients an opportunity to do two things. One is to file affidavits that would show that there would be a motion, that there would be a tribal motion on the counterclaims, and two, answer interrogatories. She gave them 7 days to do that from the December 6th. Within those 7 days, what turned out to be my clients were out seeking counsel at that point. They couldn't find anybody to take the case at a January 30th trial date, including me. And what they did is they put together written responses, and they put together, more importantly, and I think significantly, affidavits to support their counterclaims. Those affidavits had been prepared by the other law firm prior to the time they filed this motion withdrawal, but nevertheless, the affidavits were there. Those affidavits, and I think this is key, have never been questioned in terms of their acceptability or the fact that they would present questions of fact to support the counterclaims in this case. Anyway, bottom line is that the clients put those things together on December, they had the documents in by December 13th. Everything goes quiet for them until they get a motion from the Milstein law firm again that is filed on, I believe, January 9th at that point. Now we're looking at a trial date on December at the end of January. The motion for sanctions. At that point, then the clients get some assistance from me. They put together adequate responses, supplement their response to the motion to dismiss, making reference to the judge that they had done these things. At that point, we're now, there's a status conference that is scheduled in for January 17th. They filed a motion to alter or amend the summary judgment because it had been wrongfully granted, because it had been deemed confessed. And then they took steps to January 17th.
Let me ask you about the confession for just a moment.
Okay.
Was part of the response to raise material issues of fact for the benefit of the court? Or was it just to say you can't go on a confession on a summary judgment?
On the opposition to the
Yes.
The motion set aside?
Yes.
It was to raise, in part, I think, the two bases for it. One is the legal theory that the court can't make that determination on a confession. And we know that it was based upon confession as opposed to just not stating facts, because that's what she said in her order. And number two was also then to submit facts and affidavits. And I want to address that point just briefly. I think that's important because you remember the response to the motion that I filed for what amounted to a motion for reconsideration, essentially was also a motion for reconsideration filed by the plaintiff in that case, because they'd recognized the confession was improper too. So they joined in and said, please sign this other order, or, you know, show that it was more than a confession at that point. And so I think that then the submittals of all the affidavits and the other documents that were tendered at that point in time go to opposition to that motion. Thank you.
But if the information in the record otherwise indicates that summary judgment was proper, can't we affirm the trial court even if it granted judgment on a procedural basis that was not proper? In other words, it granted it for not being responded to, but if the pleadings and the other records in the file indicate that summary judgment is proper, why can't we just affirm?
Well, and Your Honor, I never attempt to tell the court what it could or could not do, but there'd be no case on point that would tell you, that would allow you to do that. The cases that I've seen indicate that a confession is just improper, it can't be done. I've not seen any case that says you can take a judgment which was rendered improperly and reaffirm it. I know there's cases on issues similar to that, that even though something was granted on other grounds, the court can decide that it was proper on different grounds, but here you don't have that. You just have a confession, which makes it a void judgment in my view. And I think that there was a concurrence on that on the part of the plaintiff. And so my affidavits and things that I submitted were basically all tendered in terms of on motions for reconsideration. So I think that we can appeal under the basis for the motion for reconsideration and on the basis that it was improperly granted as a matter of law because the judge said it was deemed confessed. I know I'm running out of time and I apologize for taking too much of my initial argument.
That's fine.
With respect to the, I'd ask you to consider my briefs and the timing there. I think if you take a look at what is written there, you'll see it's a combination of a number of factors. I'm not going to excuse everything that my clients did or didn't do, but if you take a look at it, there's a contribution here of on all parts too that led to this situation where we have a trial date on January 30th and discovery hasn't been completed. Also, I think that there is a good faith effort for them to comply with the order that had been handed down for them, and they did that.
Okay, thank you, counsel. And just to clarify, counsel, the 15 minutes is yours. Whether you use it for rebuttal or not is up to you.
Afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Chip Schoenberger, registration number 41922, and I represent Pueblo Bank and Trust. Your Honors, I'd like to start with an issue that has been troubling me since this appeal first landed on my desk. In my brief, I argue that the Lanoskas waived the majority of the arguments that they now assert on appeal. And I think it's much more problematic than that. The issue is sort of crystallized in my mind now, and I believe the court actually lacks subject matter jurisdiction to consider a lot of those issues. And let me explain why. The Lanoskas never responded to the summary judgment motion. All of the arguments that they assert now on appeal were raised in motions to reconsider that were filed months later. What they're asking the court to do now is to review the denial of those motions to reconsider. And they say that several times in their brief. I flagged page 22 as maybe the best example of it. But at the bottom of page 22, it says, the court erred in failing to grant the motions to reconsider the summary judgment. Now, that's a problem because they never appealed that ruling. They appealed on April 25th, and in the notice of appeal, they name the original summary judgment order from September of the previous year and the dismissal of their counterclaims. What they're asking the court to do is review the motions to reconsider. But at the time they filed their notice of appeal, the court hadn't ruled on the motions to reconsider yet. And those are treated as a Rule 59 motion, a post-trial motion. But under Rule 59J, those motions were automatically denied on May 29th. And they never appealed that ruling. They never filed an amended notice of appeal, and they never filed a separate notice of appeal. So I believe the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction to address any of the arguments that are raised in the motion to reconsider, which is exactly what they're asking the court to do today.
Mr. Schoenberger, did you raise this issue in your brief?
I addressed it as waiver in the brief in a different way, but ethically, I feel bound to advise the court when it lacks subject matter jurisdiction, which is also raisable, for lack of a better word, at any point in the proceedings.
Well, normally, subject matter jurisdiction refers to the category of class of cases that a court is authorized to consider. And I'm not sure how what you're saying fits into that definition of subject matter jurisdiction. It may deal with the issue of whether the notice of appeal was timely with respect to the motion to reconsider, but I'm not sure how it concerns subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, certainly it's a jurisdictional issue, whether subject matter jurisdiction or simply the court's jurisdiction to hear the issue. Timeliness affects jurisdiction. We all know that. That's a well-settled principle. And I would say there was no appeal filed from the denial of the motions to reconsider, and that is the entire world of argument on appeal with respect to the summary judgment order. And I think if the court is inclined to look at the reconsideration issues, that is viewed through a completely different lens. Motions to reconsider and post-trial motions are reviewed for an abuse of discretion. And on a motion to reconsider, the trial court is under absolutely no obligation to review new legal arguments or facts that could have been presented earlier in the case. And because the Lanoskas never responded to the summary judgment motion, everything raised in their motions to reconsider presented new arguments. And they all ended up presenting new facts that could have been raised earlier in the case.
Mr. Schoenberger, to come back to your argument about the timeliness, would you say that that Lenoska's motion to reconsider was a Rule 59 motion?
I would say the case law treats motions to reconsider summary judgment as motions for new trial under Rule 59.
And was that motion ever ruled on by the trial court?
It never was ruled on. So, actually, there were two motions. One was filed on January 17th, one was filed on February 22nd, and the court never ruled on those motions.
So then after 60 days, those motions would be deemed denied as a matter of law under Rule 59J?
That's exactly my point, Your Honor. And 63 days under the new scheduling?
Right.
But yes, that's exactly my point.
So if that's the case, then it seems like it perhaps that the notice of appeal that was filed was prematurely filed, or I guess you're saying that there needed to be another notice of appeal filed with regard to the motions to reconsider.
The notice of appeal addressed only the original summary judgment motion, which became final when the counterclaims were dismissed. The motions to reconsider are a completely different animal. It's separately appealable, and it's clear from their brief that they're asking the court to review denial of the motion to reconsider, which was never appealed.
But is their appeal timely with regard to, in your view, in regard to just the granting of the summary judgment motion?
I believe it is. It is with respect to that. They filed it 28 days, I think, after the summary judgment order became final.
And is it also timely with regard to the dismissal of the counterclaims?
I believe so.
Okay. So what is the difference then in substantively in terms of your argument about the difference between the denial or the grant rather of the original summary judgment motion and the deemed denial of the motions to reconsider?
There was no response to the summary judgment motion. So the only thing really in front of the court with respect to that is what were the trial court's obligations when it is looking at a summary judgment motion that is adequately supported and on the law should prevail on September 23rd when the court was looking at that issue, and all of the arguments raised on reconsideration 4 and 5 months later are separately appealable issue that was never appealed, and it's reviewed under a different standard.
Well, what Mr. Voss has just argued to us is that the trial court erred in saying that the summary judgment motion was granted in your favor because it was confessed, and he suggested that you even agreed to that.
I don't think we agreed that it was confessed. They raised the confession issue, and we said if that's truly what the court was doing, the court is free to enter a supplemental order detailing its findings, which the court never did. And to Judge Fox's point, when summary judgment is appropriate, this court has the authority and should affirm that summary judgment, even if the underlying rationale was incorrect. And that's essentially what the Lenoskas are arguing in this case, that confession is defective, but the court has the power to affirm for other reasons, and those reasons are clearly present in the record. There were no fact disputes, and my client met its burden of proof on summary judgment, and the court granted it. It's simple as that. If the court doesn't have any other questions about those issues, I'll move on to the issue of the sanctions real quickly. I think it's important to that the court remember the posture of the case when the claims were dismissed. At that time, they were the only claims in existence. So for all practical purposes, the Lenoskas were the plaintiffs in the case, and my client was the defendant. And we've heard a lot about all the things that happened prior to December 6th, the status conference on December 6th. The court clerk making an error, counsel withdrawing, Lenoskas thinking that the motions had been responded to when they hadn't, being rebuffed by an attorney at my firm. Well, the trial court, for the most part, didn't base its sanction on any of those circumstances. On December 6th, the trial court sanctioned the Lenoskas for intentionally failing to appear for their deposition, but it gave them a pass on not responding to discovery up until that point. And it said, you know what? File it next week. It said you have 7 days till December 13th to file all your written answers and all your documentary evidence. And at that point, it also warned them that if you file answers that are evasive and say, I don't understand the question, I will dismiss your counterclaims. And so after already being sanctioned for not appearing to their depositions, after not answering written discovery for 4 or 5 months and being warned by the trial court, what did they do? They filed written discovery responses saying, I don't understand the question. And we know that that was an intentional misrepresentation because the court at the next hearing, either January 17th or 20th, it held two more hearings, questioned them pretty extensively about it. And what the Lanoskas admitted was that before they filed or before they served their written answers, they understood what the questions were. And yet they still filed a response that said, I don't understand the question. Now, Mr. Voss pointed out that Pablo didn't come forward and complain about those evasive answers soon enough. Well, the Lanoskas didn't supplement them until 3 days, 11, 12 days before the trial. They knew, as they admitted to the trial court, that when they served their written responses on December 13th, they knew they were inaccurate. They knew they understood the question and had told Pablo that they didn't understand them. And yet, they didn't do anything to correct that mistake. They waited until Pueblo complained about it, and then they served additional responses, and they served some documents, and they said, these are some of our documents, but we still have plenty more documents that prove our counterclaims. And so, 11 days before the scheduled trial, my client, who is the defendant in this matter, is completely in the dark as to what is the basis for these claims? How are the damages calculated? What's the documentary evidence that supports it? And under those circumstances, I think the trial court was well within its discretion, having already sanctioned them once and got in and had no deterrent effect on them, was well within its discretion to dismiss the counterclaims for failing to prosecute their own claims. These were the Lanoskas' claims as the plaintiffs, the only plaintiffs in the case at the time. And I think the trial court was well within its discretion to sanction the Lanoskas under Rule 37 for expressly violating its orders. And if the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I have one last point. I say only have a few minutes left on an issue that I haven't had a chance to address in the briefs with respect to attorney's fees. The Lanoskas argue that the scope of the attorney's fees provision in the guarantee isn't broad enough to cover litigation on the counterclaims. I would point the court to the actual language of the attorney's fees provision, both in the guarantor's share of the indebtedness portion of the guarantee, as well as the attorney's fees provision, where it says attorney's fees in connection with enforcement of the guarantee. Well, these counterclaims were asserted as counterclaims in Pueblo's case and trying to enforce the guarantee. So I would say those are certainly within the scope of being in connection with enforcement of the guarantee.
Counsel, why would the entire case, the parties in the court, all have been better served if the trial court had considered different sanctions, including perhaps a continuance, a short continuance?
Well, Your Honor, two things. One, at that time, the Lanoskas were still saying, we need to get counsel. And they've been saying that for 5 or 6 months. Their counsel filed a motion to withdraw in July, was allowed to withdraw in August. They were advised of everything that was outstanding at the time. And every time they came to court, they kept saying, we need additional time. We need to hire counsel. And the trial judge at the time on December 6th, considered those issues and said, well, you haven't done anything in the last 4 months. I'm not going to continue this case for that reason. And even as much as six weeks later, when they were in front of the judge, they were still saying, we don't have counsel yet. We need time to hire counsel. And at that point, you know, the judge had already sanctioned them monetarily to no effect. The judge had already warned them that it was not going to be continued for lack of representation. And both of those warnings and sanctions had no effect on the Lanoskas. They continued to harp the same theme of, we need more time, we need to hire counsel, we haven't been able to hire anybody. And I think the court was well within its discretion at that point to put a stop to prolonged litigation where the Lanoskas were not living up to their responsibilities. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll end on that note and ask that the court affirm the rulings in their entirety.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you both for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.